This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes.
Welcome to A Conversation with History. I'm Harry Kreisler of the Institute of International Studies. Our guest today is Karen Svein, a Norwegian poet, novelist, and essayist. She made her literary debut in 1975 with Vinterhagen, a collection of poetry. She has published several novels and essay collections. She was awarded the Norwegian Language Prize in 2007. Her recent work of history is The Immigrant and the University, Pather, Sather, and Gold Rush, California. Karen, welcome to Berkeley.
Thank you very much.
Where were you born and raised?
I was born and raised in Norway, a small township named Hamar, 1 hour by car from Oslo.
And looking back, how did your parents shape your thinking about the world and about the career you undertook?
Well, my father was an iron founder and had, of course, no education, like very many in his generation. And the same is the case with my mother, who still is alive, 94 years old, a gifted woman, but no education. But we read, we had books, we listened to radio. Back then, the radio really was a sort of enlightenment program. So we learned much, we read newspapers, we discussed what we read, you know, and as I write in my book, we washed our hands when we handled the books, so it was a serious thing to read. So we had not very much money, but we had these interests, and interests that are much more than hobbies. And, well, I was also in early age, politically conscious.
And did your schooling as a young person further this interest in words and language and writing?
Well, we had not very many books at home, but we had great storytellers. And listening to these storytellers was and is maybe the most interesting and inspiring thing for me as a writer. So I have actually, from my point of view, learned as much of listening to this oral language as by reading. And that's my main interest too, to listen and to read.
Mm-hmm. And was this storytelling something you experienced at home and at school or in the culture generally?
Not very much at school, but in my home. And my mother is a great storyteller. She is still a very great inspiration for me. But we have a storytelling tradition in Norway, and not anymore, I'm sorry to say, in that degree, but that's my background. When we met privately and everywhere, people were telling stories, and through this storytelling, we learned, as a child, I learned very much about history, about community, about culture, about other people, other cultures, everything.
In what way did formal education contribute to your journey to become a writer?
I'm not sure if it contributed very much. But it depending on how you approach this topic, learning, getting knowledge is very important if you shall be in or develop yourself as a writer. But inspiration to write, to use the language, I'm sorry to say that I haven't learned very much from my teachers.
When did you, is there a moment in time when you decide, I'm going to be a writer with building on this tradition, that that's the way you want to go?
Well, I'm not sure if I had any plan at all. I know that I wrote my first poems when I was maybe 8 or 9 years old, but like very many children do. So in my when I grew up, I was interested in sports. I was a good skier, and I read books and did many things, played handball and different things. So, but in my when I went to college, then I started reading extremely much. It was like an explosion. A day or an hour without reading, it was absolutely nothing for me. And I have to admit, it still is like that, more or less. So that was my second source of inspiration, the books, the literature. And, you know, it was philosophy, history, political science, all and other very heavy things for a teenager. But that was my then. I felt now I'm on the track after myself in a way. And from then, my education, I'm still a student. I'm still interested in everything. In my life, there is not one big thing. I have lots of interests. I can listen to classical music and to country music. I can read Dante and I can read a crime story or what you call it. Not that much, the last thing I have to say. But I have lots of interests, deep interests. Not only, you know, thing you can have a conversation about or of.
So I hear you saying that it wasn't at the university. It wasn't the formal education, but it was rather a place where a bigger part of the world opened up to you.
Yes,
through reading.
Absolutely. Maybe it's my fault or problem, but I never felt the university as a place for me. I felt like an outsider there in many ways. When it comes to reading and thinking and writing, but the place, the environment, I didn't belong there. Mm-hmm. And that's then. Back then, it was like scaring to go there. I didn't feel at home at all.
You sound like a natural born scholar, as opposed to a scholar in the university.
Yes. Absolutely.
So you've written poetry in your native language and several novels. Are there themes that interest you before we talk about the Pather Sather book that you would like to explain to us? What have you wound up focusing on in your other work?
When you read my books, I think you will see, we will meet conflicts between, it's a kind of description of the modern Norway, the cultural conflicts, the social conflicts, the historical background for developing of the modern welfare state. That's a frame for all my books, I think.
The modern welfare state.
Absolutely.
Yeah,
and the differences between classes, because I am an Iron Founder's daughter. So it's natural for me to write from that point of view. One of my collections of essays is named Journey Between Classes, in English, Klassereise in Norwegian. Described as one of the most important books after the Second World War in Norway, because it describes this development of the modern Norwegian society after World War II. Norway was a very poor country for hundreds of years until, I have to say, turn of the century, after World War II, when people like me got the possibility to have an education, go to the university. From the 1950s, you had a great change in Norwegian society when everyone got was admitted to had the access to higher education. It changed totally the Norwegian society. So that's a major topic in my books.
So do the essays sort of describe the tensions and conflict that emerge as you get a broader middle-class, educated society?
Well, I approach these themes in a rather philosophical way. It's not about class struggle or theories of socialism and such things. It's based on my own life experience combined with my own thoughts about the parallels in the Norwegian society, Scandinavian societies, and Western Europe societies too. So for me, to get an education, to be a writer, has meant absolutely everything for me. It has changed my life. It has sent me to Berkeley, and to come here, it's absolutely unthinkable for anyone in my family at all. So I'm so happy and grateful and humbled to be here, for instance.
Let's talk a little about writing. You're a poet, you're a novelist, now you're a historian. What are the skills, do you think, are involved in being a great writer?
You have to be totally involved, totally interested. That's a common trait for writing everything from poetry to this biography, for instance. But you also need to have broad interests. You have to be enlightened. You have to be well educated. You have to have knowledge to be a poet and to be write academic literature or text like this book. From my point of view, writing poetry demands logic. It has its own logic, but we think people think and believe that it's enough to look at the sun in the morning racing over the hills and so on to get inspired, and that poetry is based on these feelings and impressions. Well, in one way, but it has its logic. That's a link between my writing in different genres.
And what about temperament? I guess as a writer, since you have to be very focused on your work, there's an element of being able to deal with loneliness, to be alone. There's you, the page, and the pen, right?
Yeah. But I can feel alone among people, but not when I'm writing.
I see. So it's not okay. All right. So what is the feeling when you're writing?
It's a feeling of being in the right place. You know, which I very seldom experience. When I'm among other people, for instance. So, but when I'm sitting there in my office writing, often very late in the evening, and the whole day is when I'm writing day and night. So I don't want to call it happy, but I'm content. I am very conscious, very concentrated. I can work for 12 hours, and I feel lucky. It's meaningful, this feeling of being in the right place or on the right spot or what you call it. That's something very common for us human beings to experience that, because we feel so strange very often. So when I write, I am at home. I feel that I belong to a larger world.
I guess that the materials that you work with as a writer, whether as a poet or a historian, require that you be able to observe and to listen and to record when you're not writing. In other words, and then to bring those to this place where you're truly comfortable with what you're doing.
Yes. I have been or acted in that way since I was a little girl, because I always, when we went to town, for instance, and saw different buildings or structures or art or what it was, I asked my mother, what is it? Why is it placed here? So she had to tell me about the story back beyond everything. And I learned that we don't just live in a world of today. It has its backdrop, historic backdrop. It has its stories. And that feeling, I really felt that through her storytelling, a large world of history opened. So I always been like this, registered, listened, learned in that way.
Let's now talk about your book, which I will show again, The Immigrant and the University. And you come here, and here you see the campus, the Campanile, the Sather Gate. And interestingly enough, the gate seems to be a remarkable rendering of what you've just described to us. That is, a gate opening up into the world of knowledge. And you discovered that the gate is named after a Norwegian. Then what happened?
Well, I come here for 1 year and to learn and to be abroad, to experience and to write. And I wrote a book here. So, but I had some plans of experience a modern world in in the Bay Area and California, and which I did, of course. But then there was this Sather Gate, or Sather Gate, and when I learned that this name Sather may have been Norwegian, I started to ask who was this man. It Sather Gate is erected in memory of Peder Sather. Who was this man? I know that knew that most Norwegian immigrants settled as farmers in the Midwest and so on. What brought this Peder Sather here? And what connection had he to the university? And I also knew that no other Norwegian immigrant had anything to do with education or higher education. I didn't know anything, but it awakened my curiosity. I saw some parallels in a way. Me coming here in this century, and this Peder going here. How did he come here? What did he do here? And I was so amazed by the thought of this maybe young man coming here alone, establishing himself here. I wanted to know how life was back then, and so on.
So you commit yourself to undertaking this journey of understanding, let's call it.
Yeah.
And what you discover is, if I can say it this way, nobody knows the answer to the question you're asking, not even the Bancroft Library.
No.
So talk a little about that, because that was really a shock.
Yeah, absolutely. Or nobody really knew anything about Peder Sather. There was no books about him, no articles, nothing. But among the Scandinavians here, Norwegian Americans here in Bay Area, somebody told me that he had been a banker Yeah, but still I didn't know his link to the university, and why the tower and the gate and the professorships and so on. So for some strange reason, I bit the bullet and thought, I will find out this. And how it's very difficult to understand how this happened. But it was like an obsession for years, actually. The research, all the archives or the libraries and so on, I have consulted to do it in America. There is nothing in known about Peter Sæther in Norway either. And no archives, nothing, absolutely nothing. National Library in Oslo has his will. That's the only thing to find there. So
let's explain to our audience who doesn't know. So here you come here, and the main physical structures that symbolize the university, namely the Sæther Gate, which is the main gate to the opening of the campus, a beautiful gate, the Campanile, which is a tower, a clock tower, which everyone associates also with the campus. You learn that there are three professorships named after Peter Sæther. There is a law library named the Sæther Library. And so these are the physical objects that it's clear they bear his name, and he had something to do with the bequest that gave them. But there are other unknown things yet that he gave to the university, but nobody knows who he is. So the poet, novelist, essayist becomes a historian, but in the course of doing that, has to become a detective because there's no documentation really of anything.
No. No, and that's strange. How there seems to be so little documents or material to find about Peter Sæther. Did he hide his tracks? Maybe, but you can't be sure. Different circumstances may give a reason for this lack of information about him. Private circumstances and public too. Jane Krohm Sæther, which erected the Sæther Gate and Sæther Tower, she left no children. And Peter and Sarah or Jane were married for just 4 years. So there were, in a way, nobody to take care of the heritage, the cultural heritage, Peter Sæther's life story and so on. Nobody took care of it in family and among the friends. So it was a lot of tragic circumstances too in his life that made this happen.
So let's explain to our audience. Peter Sæther was married to one woman, Sarah, for 40 plus years. Then she died, and he married a second time to Jane Krohm, who was his second wife for 4 years, and was the executor, primary executor of his will, and she was the one who gave the money for the chairs, the gate, and the campanile. But he had been a benefactor of the university in ways unknown, which is part of what you discovered. So let's then, one other thing that's very important here is, what did you wind up using as documentation? So you had to go to obscure items from history, advertisements, announcements in the paper, and so on. Talk a little about that, because we can see how you did that, because you've been reading all this time. It's just you had to go to different places to find the material to read.
Very many places. But the main sources or archives for me have been newspaper archives from California, from New York, and the East Coast, and general newspaper archives. That's second-hand sources. But well, I was the slightest nugget of information was meaningful when in my search for sort of understanding his movements and his works and everything. Everything was interesting for me. A small advertisement with an address could make me trace him or track him around the corner and in a new connection. Well, where bad described by me, but you have the newspaper archives, you have the general literature. Peter Sater established himself as a banker in New York City in mid-1830s before he moved here during the Gold Rush and established a bank here in Montgomery Street in San Francisco. He became one of California's absolutely richest men and lived his last years over in Oakland, where Preservation Park is located today. Well, but so I had to read general financial literature, general history, American history, Norwegian, some Norwegian history, and public sources like census, city directories, someone.
And you discovered a cache of letters in a Sacramento historical library of one of his bookkeepers.
Right. When Peter Sater lived in Manhattan and Brooklyn and worked as a banker there and established himself with the family there, He had a friend who actually was an iron founder, like my father. Peter Sater had friends among the elites and among ordinary people. So this iron founder in Manhattan, living in Lower East Side, Downing Street, very poor man. Received help from Peter Sater to go to San Francisco during the Gold Rush. And this man, Anthony Louis Teixeira, and his wife, Elisa, they were writing to each other, had a correspondence through the years they were separated on the East and West coast. That collection of letters are stored at Sacramento or California State Library in Sacramento. Almost 50 handwritten large letters, which contain so much interesting information about the Gold Rush, about the Teixeira family, of course, but also about Peter Sater's daily life in Brooklyn, in Manhattan, and here in San Francisco. I will say that's my main primary source.
So Peter Sater comes to the United States and really works his way up in banking circles that in a way are being established in America for the first time. And he becomes, because of his skills in networking and dealing with people, he becomes part of what is emerging as a national network of banking, not in the sense that there was one bank that controlled all the banks, but in the sense that to do their business, banks had to communicate with each other. For Peter Sather, this was very important when he ultimately decides to move west to California. And he comes to California, and this is where your book really becomes a social history of California, not just a biography of Peter Sather. This is the Gold Rush. And when you have a commodity like gold, then it has to be taken to banks. weighed and then turned into a fungible currency, and hence the importance of this network of banks.
Yes. in this Toshaira letter collection, there is a letter telling about how Peter Sater was connected with one of the largest financiers back then, Francis Drexel, in Francis Martin Drexel, based in Philadelphia. He established, together with his sons, the banking house of Drexel and Co., which established themselves with the largest structure at Wall Street in the 1870s. Peter Sater met this Francis Drexel in New York. He was older than Peter Sater, was an immigrant from Austria. He had been a painter and a portrait painter and established himself to earn money for his family, trying to establish an exchange brokerage in Philadelphia. And so become one of the greatest financiers of his time. But during the gold rush, Francis Drexel offered Peter Sater money for establishing a bank here in San Francisco, Washington Street, which they did. Without the support from Francis Drexel, Peter Sater couldn't have established a bank on his own here.
And Peter Sather was a very pragmatic, practical man who actually, through practice, developed a vision and a diversification of his business interests.
Yeah.
So he starts in banking. He develops those connections, but then he moves into real estate, and then he moves into insurance, and all the time sort of riding the waves of the initial development of California.
Yeah. Let me repeat or say that Peter Sater had no education. He was a self-made man. He started as a lottery seller in Manhattan before moving here. Here, his ability to communicate, to make friends, networking, as you call it today, must have been very impressive. And if you read all the famous men he was connected to, it was the elite here in California and over on the East Coast. So he was was all his lifetime what you call a public-minded man, charitable, friendly, everything. All my sources, newspapers and letters, tells about a benefactor, caring for other people, interested in society, of building up this state of California, the city of San Francisco, and was involved in absolutely. It's easier to answer what he was not involved in than what he was involved in. But he had no education himself. He was self-made in many ways. And as a banker, he was a banker of the old school, spreading the risks on several feet, or what you call it, as real estate, as insurance, and traditional banking. So that was the main reason why the bank, Sather and Church and Sather and Company in San Francisco, was one of the only two, to survive the 19th century. The other bank was Wells and Fargo, which was, by the way, his friends from New York.
The question arises, which you address, He was a Norwegian coming from humble beginnings. He emigrates here for personal reasons. So how, as America became a place of opportunity for him, how did America change him? You record a cycle almost that he goes through. He becomes a Baptist, and so on.
Yeah, I think America totally changed his life. In Norway, he would have had no opportunities at all, for different reasons. Both of his parents, for instance, died when he was before he was 11. He had absolutely no possible. Yeah, Norway got its first university in 1913. Peter Sæther had no money. He had to emigrate to change his life dramatically. So when he arrived here in Manhattan, he became a Baptist. Very strange, I have to say. I call it in my book, I think, a kind of second emigration. He had to leave the past and establish himself and build up his persona in a new way, in a new language, in a new country, in every way. So in that light, I can see this baptism as a kind of logical consequence of the immigration.
And you mentioned this already, but we should emphasize this. Before he embarks on his involvement with the University of California, he was quite an important civic leader, community organizer of charities for seamen, very tolerant and caring for the freed slaves, some of whom were in California, concerned about all sorts of civic matters and sort of an energizing force in all of them.
Absolutely.
Some related to the church, but some just civically concerned.
Yeah, he was involved in this American Freedmen Freedmen's Union Aid and Union Commission. It was a correct name. For many years after the Civil War, he was a supporter of women's equal rights when it comes to education. He was a liberal man, a kind of social democrat. When I read about Peter Sæther, I think he must have been the first social democrat ever. Coming to the big world from Norway. Another thing, he was a member of the trustees, board of trustees of the College of California, the forerunner to the university. In 1867, he sent a petition to the legislation in Sacramento, asking them to increase the taxes to make schooling for all the children of California possible. To suggest to increase the taxes was really, really very radical back then. So it says much about Peter Sæther's commitments to establish the young California, state of California, when it comes to public education, healthcare, everything.
In your analysis of California, Gold Rush California, you point out two things that are quite relevant here. One is the individualism that characterized the culture here, which is true of the United States generally, but in a way was intensified by the horrible conditions of coming out here to mine gold, being on your own and surviving, and then, if you were lucky, making it on the one hand. But you also point out, interestingly, that one of the problems with developing public services or a sense of community in California was that everybody who came didn't think they would stay.
Right.
They thought they would go back to the East once they've made their fortune. And so both the dynamic of both of these things create a space in which nobody cares about the public good except private sector individuals who were rare, like Peder Sather.
Yeah, right. And maybe the church is different denominations.
Yeah. The different churches here, which were also a source of community.
Yeah, so in a way you have this early individualism, which was actually described. The word was used in describing the town of city of San Francisco in the early 1850s. In the letters, letter collection I have mentioned. Very surprising, I think, that the word was used. This term was used already then to describe this lonely crowds. It's Anthony Teixeira, the miner, who used this word. He feels so sorry for all the people in the streets. They look so lonely and so on. But on the one side, you have this individualism in the public, and you have this more collective mind in the churches, in these religious societies. Very strange, this difference.
Let's now talk about Peder Sather's involvement with the founding of the university. So he's invited to be part of a small committee of clergy and businessmen that founds the College of California, which in turn becomes the University of California several years later. He was ambivalent about whether he would be part of this. Is that correct in the beginning?
Yes, he was hesitating, surprised maybe, everything. And I don't know why. Maybe he had much to do, too much to do. But he joined this. He was elected a member of this board of trustees at a very historical meeting up at the Founders Rock here at the UC campus at the corner of Gailey and Hearst. At the historical meeting, April 16, 1860. Then the College of California had been in work for 5 years. When Peder Sather was elected a member of the board, at that meeting, the decision were made where the UC Berkeley should be placed. But, well, he hesitated. And he was a member of the board for 3 years, and was worked as a fundraiser for the university too. He was a great benefactor. Different
and
sources.
He gave land and
money. Different sources states that. So, but he hesitated. He had for different reasons. Maybe he was as insecure as I am, in a way, because his background, because his lack of education, and at the same time interest in education. So, but no, I don't want to say much more about that. He was insecure, but he said yes, and he took part of the board, or was a member board of the board for this 3 years. Peder Sather was one of very many. Trustees through the years from the early 1850s until the university opened its doors in 1868.
Is it surprising that he became involved with the university given the fact that he had minimal education, he was self-education, he was a very practical man, but here he was part of an effort to establish the a university. There was argument about whether it should be a religious school, but then the choice was made that that wouldn't be the case and that there would be teaching of classics and literature and all of those things that aren't inevitably part of the learning of experience of a businessman.
Yeah. Well, to understand this, Peter Sæther was a practical man, and as the whole period was a practical period, and named so by different historians. But if you take a look at Peter Sæther's friends and at the East Coast, for instance, his most intimate friend during his whole life was Francis Drexel's son, Anthony Drexel, by many considered as a founder of the Wall Street, the man who made Wall Street. Well, he too, he lived in Philadelphia. He's a very famous figure in American history, not only as a big banker, but also as a philanthropist and very occupied in public education. He himself, for instance, established the Drexel University or Institute in Philadelphia. Peter Cooper, the engineer, self-made man, illiterate in his childhood. He established this Cooper Union in Manhattan, which were established to give blacks, girls and boys from the working class or lower social classes, education, and women too, and Indians. So this was Peter Sæther's, environment when it comes to education, ideas of culture, everything. He had this inspiration from them, and he had, he himself was inspired by this. He regretted his whole life that he had no education when he was a boy. So he was really occupied. So when he was elected a member of the Board of Trustees, that was from very good reasons.
We should talk briefly. We mentioned his second wife, Jane, who was a modern woman who, after he died, they had been married 4 years, was a person who... Was she Norwegian, by the way, or not? Was she Norwegian?
Jane?
Yeah.
No.
She was not.
It's very interesting. Jane Krum... As a Hollandish or from Netherlands, her family. Jane Krum was born in a small township named Shokan in Ulster County in upstate New York. There she was a small farmer's daughter. She had 15 siblings. And she, as far as I know, never married. She lived together with her sisters. She had maybe 8 sisters and 7 brothers or so, and moved from place to place, to Manhattan, Brooklyn, New York too, where her sister Lucinda lived together with her Norwegian husband, Hans Rees, who was Peter Sæther's closest friend. So in 1844, Jane Krum, very well known here at the UC campus, met Peter Sæther and Sarah Thompson, which Peter was married to for 46 years in New York. And since then, Jane was a friend of the Sæthers. And after Sarah, who was born in Connecticut, Bridgeport, Hartford area. When she died in New York in 1881, Peter Sæther married Jane the year after here in Oakland.
So she was a very modern woman. She had lived in something like a commune, where there was an emphasis on the environment and women's rights and so on. And then after he died, she was coming to the campus a lot to take hear lectures and so on. And so it was her vision as executor of the state that led to even more generosity by the Peter Sæther family, although he had passed away. So in a way, she's the silent Pather Sather was lucky to marry a woman who seemed to have a great educational vision in her own right, and actually belonged to a club of women in San Francisco, of professional women who talked with each other about their careers and what they could learn. So she was a real forerunner of what would become, you know, women's movement and then women's liberation.
Absolutely. Absolutely. She was a suffragist. She was a member of different organizations, one of them which I think you thought of was this Sorosis, society, established in New York in the 1870s. So she was a very modern woman. Very independent, intellectual. The newspapers ridiculed her for being an eccentric, but she was nobody's fool at all. And she and Peter was what I... Also, that was a real couple in a way. He was married to Sarah for 46 years, but he had Jane as a friend through all these years. They shared interests. They were the real couple. It's a real love story. This story about Peter as a private man, Peter between Sarah and Jane. So his luckiest year, I think, he had when he married Jane in Oakland and lived there for 4 short years before he died in 1886. So it's no surprise that to me, and if you read the book, that Jane donated large parts of his fortune to the university. That was in his spirit, and of course in hers. Peter had five children. Peter and Sarah had five children. Three of them died from typhus. One got mentally ill. And the one who survived, Josephine, she lived very, very lavishly. High life in Monterey, San Francisco, Newport, Rhode Island, Paris, London, everywhere. So this Peter Sather, her father, was very aware of. So you can say that Jane, his second wife, really saved this money for the public good.
Well, I have one final question for you. Our time is almost up. How did your career, poet, novelist, essayist, an appreciator of education, how did it prepare you to see the importance of this story and write it so that now for the first time we understand the legacy of the man whose name and his wife's name is on the gate that opens everybody up for the first time to the world of higher learning? What prepared you? Was it you being Norwegian? Was it your skills as your hidden skills as a detective? Was it your imagination? What?
Of course, it had something to do with me and Peter Sather being Norwegians, of course. And when I learned that he had been one of the trustees, benefactor, you know, everything, I was proud of that a young man from a small, poor country had in one way or another been involved in establishing this outstanding university. Of course I was proud and still am. So I think from a Norwegian point of view, it would be very nice if people back in Norway can learn about him and his contributions here in the community. So, but when that is said, it has to do with my imagination, because I know from that day I learned that Peter Sather was native, Norway, man from Norway, Norwegian immigrant. Well, then it started developing a lot of ideas, of images, you know, sailboats, ship, traveling, the way back, the life back then, how was it? I have to learn about it. And, well, the inspiration was based on these images, as it also do when I write poems, novels, short stories, and so on. So there is absolutely a link, a creative link between writing the essays, biography, and this fictional books.
Well, on that note, Karen, I think we've convinced everybody they should go out and buy your book and read it, because it's an important story for the University of California and its emergence and now is the greatest public university. So thank you very much for writing the book and coming on our program.
Thank you very much for inviting.
And thank you very much for joining us for this conversation with history.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.